Hello and welcome to another episode of the Albion Roar here on Radio Reverb 97.2 FM, online at radioreverb.com, on DAB, and of course, on our podcast. I'm Ailey Packham and we're wondering, is it safe to look up yet? In association with oldfootballshirts.com. Yes, that's right. Last Saturday's somewhat easy win over a lacklustre Newcastle put down a marker and has lifted us 6 points above the drop zone with a game in hand. We're not safe yet, but if the Geordies continue to play like that, then hopefully we can look forward to a record fifth season at the top table. In other news, Albion women's defender Maya Letizia has been named as one of the top 10 best young women footballers in the world in the prestigious Goal 2021 Next Gen Awards. And also this week, football has lost one of its most colourful characters in the shape of former Albion striker Frank Worthington, who sadly died this week at the age of 72.
Joining me today is, as ever, Alan Wares, and later on we'll be joined by former Albion captain Danny Wilson.
Al, it's been a good week, and let's start off with Newcastle. And that was remarkably easy.
Well, for our listener who tuned in to last week's show and heard the brilliant Vicky Rees and her pre-match rant about just how dreadful Newcastle were, I mean, I think I could just play it afterwards and think, well, there's the point. They were truly appalling. When you see them and you see the quality of players that are there, and we're not talking rubbish, but somewhere down the line, this is really a case. With the Albion, you get the feeling that we are greater than the sum of our parts. That's not to say that we have mediocrity in our side, but you get the feeling that with the Albion, some of the players, they wouldn't necessarily fit so well into another Premier League side. Most would, some might not. But with Newcastle, they are bustling with Premier League players, and they just didn't seem to give a damn. There is something intrinsically wrong at Newcastle United. What it is, we'd have to have a Newcastle fan on, and even they will probably be struggling to shine a light into the dark areas. But whatever it is, it comes out and manifests itself in such an appalling performance, which, if that was us, we'd be screaming for...
I was seriously scratching my head out because, I mean, going into this game, and if you listen to the show last week, you'll know that I was a little bit nervous going into it because it was a massive opportunity for us to put... Well, yeah, it was an opportunity to put down a marker and to put some daylight between us and them and the bottom three, particularly after Fulham losing as well. Yeah. And it was...
I mean,
let's face it. I mean, we were brilliant. We played very, very well. And Newcastle had no answer to us. And it was a Graham Potter coaching masterclass, quite frankly. I mean, watching it... I mean, obviously, unfortunately, I was lucky enough to be in the stadium. And you're watching this... This strange formation. I was talking to Brian Owen before the game, and we had no idea what the formation was going to be, because where's he going to play then? And it's like, and then they come out, and you've got Pascal Gross as a wing back, Modo as a wing back, and you've got basically the two strikers. You've got Morpay and Welbeck hugging the touchline.
Yeah, you've got Lallana in goal. You've got Sanchez is playing as referee. It doesn't, you scratch out, but to be honest with you, AD, every single game, people are saying, it's the Potter lottery. It's, how is he going to line up? And you look at the formation, and yet, some days it works, some days it doesn't. But I don't think it's down to necessarily the fact that someone is, quote, playing out of position. You know, the criticism that comes across saying, you've got to have a specialist midfielder in a specialist midfield place. Graham Potter is actually destroying quite a lot of the previous received wisdom as to who should be doing what and who should be playing where. You know, Zakaria at left wing back and Gross at right wing back doesn't make sense. It's like putting lager on your porridge. It doesn't, well, for some it might make sense, but it doesn't make sense.
And I should just point out, actually, just put it on the record, that Andy Sakiri is playing for the Switzerland under-21s this week and was brilliant against the England under-21s.
Should have beat Switzerland one anyway, so...
But it was It was such an eye-opening performance, really. I mean, the fact that Newcastle had no answer to us, and I was in the press conference afterwards, and Steve Bruce said, "We're no disrespect to Brighton," three times, we didn't have an answer for him, and it's like, hang on, we beat you 3-0 early in the season as well. I mean, by saying no disrespect to Brighton, you're disrespecting Brighton, basically.
What you've got to bear in mind is I think that Newcastle and the way they're set up and their attitude to possibly playing Brighton is that they are the perfect team for Graham Potter to play because of the nature of the way they set up. You know, if you're playing certain other teams, it's more difficult to do that. But having said that, let's look back at the games that we've had in 2021 and a few before that. We've taken teams apart. Don't get me wrong, the Brighton Newcastle one, because it was 3-0, and frankly, Newcastle were lucky to get nil. It makes it look as though just absolutely everything fell into place. And yet we've had so many games in the past where we've done exactly the same and just not scored. If we just tucked away those three goals in games that frankly we should have done, then we're just saying it's another day at the office. But yeah, you're quite right. What's happened here is that Newcastle have turned up, been made to look poor, frankly been made to look as though they're playing football from another era, been made to look poor by a Brighton side whose setup actually suits playing against Newcastle. And in that sense, it shows up Newcastle to look even worse than they possibly are. It's just that we're in a similar position, but thankfully it's the direction of travel that both clubs are on.
Well,
anybody makes us feel a bit better
on that performance from the Geordies. Anyone that finishes above Newcastle stays up. I mean, it was that bad.
Yeah,
it
I know. Really, but that bad. There are still 9 games to go, and you can't assume that they are going to be that bad.
Absolutely, and we've got some big games coming up ourselves. Okay, but it was a first start for Jakub Moda. What did you make of his contribution out of position?
How do you call it out of position? You know, if you're on the pitch, you know, you're in position, frankly. He looks absolutely perfectly set to be a Brighton player because in the first 2 minutes, he squandered a couple of sitters.
I know. But it was just absolutely wonderful play. I mean, how he was given the freedom of the pitch to end up in that position is
that's another matter. But once it came to the finishing the article, then you think, you'll fit in well here. I mean, of course, I'm being sort of cynical here, but the fact is that here we have this nominal left wing back going flying on through because Mopey's over there, sitting in row Z of the West Stand. You've got Welbeck, you know, he's hugging another touchline. And Newcastle are going, well, where on earth are we supposed to mark these players?
The formation worked, it allowed Trossard and Lallana the freedom of the middle of the pitch to do what they want, pretty much.
What it did is it split the defenders because they were playing so wide.
Well, that's something that Warren Aspinall has been saying for a long time. You move their defenders around, and
this is what they always do. Because as much as Welbeck was started off on the left hand side, like when it is Welbeck, Trossard and Mopey, all three of them will interchange. You know, you'll have it then that Mopey will turn up on the left and Welbeck will be in the middle and then Trossard will be in the middle. And then, you know, but the point is that when you spread them that far, it allows someone else to come through and you're assuming it's going to be Lallana or it's going to be Bissouma, but it's not. It's the left back. He just goes hurtling through. So when you say he's out of position, yeah, he starts life as a left wing back, but I think the back is a little bit of a misnomer. And B, he just happens to be kind of covering a sort of vague general left-hand side of the pitch. And then, you know, Newcastle saying, well, who's picking him up? Is it supposed to be a forward? Is a forward supposed to be... And it's a nightmare for Steve Bruce, which frankly, somewhere down the line, he either A, hasn't got the nous to do, or B, hasn't got the inclination from his players to actually do their job.
Well, the body language of their players as they were coming off the pitch was of a team.
That was shocking.
It was terrible. Well, okay, but we've been critical of Leandro Trossard this season, but he's been coming to the fore recently, and that playing in that kind of like a number 10 role certainly suits him a lot better. Actually, which of the two identikit goals was your favourite? Firstly.
I think that the first one meant more because it meant we went into the break at 1-0, and I think it eased them a little bit.
Oh, I know. I'd already been started. I started writing my halftime report, and
yeah,
then we scored, and I had to delete it, or I was not happy.
Incidentally, but... I did make a point of looking at the clock, and that injury to Hayden was unfortunate, and you know, Bissouma looked genuinely crestfallen.
Yeah, he was crying.
Yeah, but I would also say that looking at the clock, the referee underplayed that half by 2 minutes. 2 minutes. I mean, you know, that's probably the 2 minutes that we should have had against Manchester United, you know. We can have those minus 2 minutes back. But no, for me, I think the first one was kind of more important because it possibly changed Graham Potter's thinking a little bit into, right, we're one up. Now, you know, we don't have to work so hard for our second goal because we've already got our first goal. Yeah, it was a great finish, but therein lies the issue. For all three of them, for Welbeck, for Trossard, and for Mopay, there are no excuses left now because they showed us that they can do it. For anything that you're unlucky, you're this, you're that, you're in the wrong position, you didn't get it right, you know, sorry, they set themselves up, they bulleted them into the corner. You know, there was Mopay's, you know, really clever falling volley, really good, nicely adjusted. They can do it.
That was an instinctive finish from Morpay, and when he hasn't got time to think about it, he does tend to put it away.
No, when he doesn't think about it, he just sort of like he flashes wildly. But it wasn't. I don't think it was a no thought thing. I think it was deliberate. He guided that ball past the goalkeeper. He didn't swing his foot at it. He didn't thrash at it. He leant purposely to guide it past the goalkeeper. He knew what he was doing. It was a superb finish.
Yeah.
And the
Did you notice, Al, by the way, that one interesting facet of this game was that we'd obviously targeted their goalkeeper's right-hand side. Was it right or like right-hand? Yeah, right. I can't remember. One side. All of our shots were on exactly the same side of the goal in the whole game.
The first two goals were to the keeper's left and the third one was to the right. And let's put it this way, you weren't going to tell Mopay, I'll put it in the left-hand side because that's, even though that was his near post. I think it's just one of those things of make sure you put it into the far corner, because if he does get it down, and I mean, it's what you tell any striker, shoot across the keeper so that if he does save it, he tips it back out into play and hopefully into some oncoming traffic. It's just that both those shots, you know, it really was genuinely like your textbook number 19 bus. You wait for ages for a goal, and then three turn up really, really good.
I mean, I've got to say, Al, I mean, it's
been coming.
It was. I mean, we've had. It was going into the game. I was quite tense, but coming out of the stadium, that's the most relaxed I've been.
Well, when you're 3-0 up against the rubbish side
for a couple of years, I think, because it's, I mean, our performances at home haven't been good enough this season. Well, the performances have been all right, but the results haven't been good enough. But it was just coming out of that stadium, and it was just to feel relaxed and not to have a care in the world. And
you say this, mate. I mean, what it is that again, we bossed another side, yet another side, we bossed the game. The difference being is that we tucked our chances away. And when the third went in, you think, well, okay. You know, when the second went in, you think, okay, good, but all Newcastle need is a sort of a mossy slip or a bit of genius, and it's 2-1 and it's game back on. And can they game manage from there? But when the third went in, frankly, you know, it only looked like it was the next goal scorers were going to be us. And yes, okay, you can relax. And you're actually willing the team on, come on, let's you know, not take our foot off the throat. You know, we need the goals. We need the confidence. But that's been the difference, that you can walk away from that relaxed, puff on the imaginary cigar, is because not only did we actually take another team apart, we actually did it by finishing with goals. And that's, frankly, if we can do that next season in the Premier League on a more regular basis, we are going to be such a bunch of happy fans.
Yeah. Absolutely. And next up is Man United on Easter Sunday. So let's hope we can come away from there with something. But OK, we are delighted to welcome back a former Albion captain who played 155 times for the Albion, scoring an impressive 39 goals between 1983 and 1987. Please welcome Danny Wilson. Danny, welcome to the Roar.
Good afternoon. Thanks for having me on.
That is really impressive for a midfielder, 39 goals in 155 appearances. That's amazing.
I was a strange sort of player. I don't think I had one particularly great strength. I think I could get forward, I could defend a little bit, I could tackle a bit. I was okay in the air for a midget, but
you're being a bit modest here, aren't you, mate?
No, not at all. I think I had a little bit of everything. I was fortunate.
Yeah, I mean,
you were also the penalty taker, though, weren't you?
Yes, I was. Well, he does help. Yeah, of course he does. it's from that point of view.
Now, Danny, well, let's talk about how you came to the Albion. It's a story which we've been told firsthand by Chris Catlin. I don't know if you remember, Al, that Cat went off on a various flights of fancy on one of our live shows.
He tried to get drunk one time, yeah. But tell us, I mean, we've heard it from the Albion's point of view, but tell us from your point of view, bearing in mind just how obstinate Cluppy was being, how it is you came, from your point of view, how you came to join the Albion?
Well, I had a spell where I think Brian Clough, the manager, had sent a few phone calls from various clubs about me going out on loan. One of them being Southampton, and there was an exchange going on with a couple of players from Southampton heading towards Nottingham and me going the other way. But as it sort of got closer and closer to the day, the gaffer put me in. Mr. Clough put me in and says, Danny, say it's all off, we're not doing it. But we've got another club coming in for you, and they'd like to take you on a permanent deal, and that's Brighton. So, from my point of view, I was young, I was still only 21, I think, something like that. And I wanted to play regular football and I was bitten and bopping really in Nottingham Forest team. I'd had a bit of a run. And then after that, it was a bit off the bench type of thing. So I needed regular football. And I suppose, Mr. Clough decided that, that was exactly what he felt I needed as well. And that's what happened. But I believe the negotiations were a little bit fractious at times. Maybe Kat might have told you that. But, you know the story better than I will.
Well, when you consider it's actually not exactly two dying swans of Brian Clough and Chris Catlin trying to negotiate. I mean, don't get me wrong, Chris Catlin is, he's no shrinking violet, but he was still kind of in awe of being in Brian Clough's company. But I think it was along the lines that Cat was so keen to get you. I think that the sort of the conversation goes is that Cat phoned up Cloughy and said, it's Chris Catlin here, manager of Brighton of Albion. He said, do you know it's Sunday? And Kat just went, yeah, it's Sunday here too. Can I sign Danny Wilson, please? Yeah.
I mean, I think the fact that you ended up here had a lot to do with the fact that Kat had a rock shop and Cluffy's brother-in-law had a sweet factory in Middlesbrough.
That was their thing, yeah.
I think that was the way that they both got the chat in at some stage in the...
I've got to ask this, Danny. I mean, when you came down here, at a funny time in the club's history. We'd just been relegated from the top division. We had a newish manager who had to run everything on a shoestring. With all due respect, he really had to sort of drive the price down to get you. I mean, don't get me wrong, we're glad he got you. But you came at a funny time. So when you came to the club, could you feel that? Could you experience that? What were your first thoughts about when you turned up at the Goldstone or the training ground first time?
Well, I think you look at the players that surrounding you, you're going to be playing with. And that was, from my point of view, a terrific side that I know they've been relegated, but there was still some quality in the club. And I think that, the way that, the likes of Steve Foster, and I'll name Steve in particular because he was a big influence and a big settling part of my coming into the club. He helped me a great deal, both on and off the field. And I think that you need things like that. And that's what, it helped me to settle in and helped my family settle in when they eventually came down, more than anything. I think the way it was, the club was run, not just from the top, but certainly inside within the dressing room, was such a family-orientated surroundings that you know, we went in very, very quickly. And it was great from day one. I enjoyed it from day one. It didn't take me any time at all to settle in.
Sure. Yeah, I mean, for a lad from Wigan, which is Al's musical spiritual home,
I was going to ask about that, but we'll come back to that.
But I mean, when you went to Bury, famously, you didn't know where Bury was, and it was only like a half mile down the road. But it was
really.
Yeah. But it must have been a bit of a culture shock coming down from the north down to the cosmopolitan, glamorous south for you.
Well, it was in one respect, you know, but I mean, when you're a young boy, I was like 16, 17 when I moved away from home, from Wigan. And obviously, you're right, you said the first time was Bury, it was about 30 miles away. I hadn't got a clue, I've never heard of it. But once you make that first initial move away from your apron strings and your mum, if you like, and your dad, you soon get used to. You're standing on 2 feet very quickly. You have to do. And so it could have been Timbuktu for me. It didn't really matter where it was after that first move. You know, I could have gone anywhere. I could have gone abroad. It really didn't make any difference to me. I just wanted to play football. So, you know, the South Coast and the reputation that Brighton had, you know, already was a big, big bonus from my point of view. You know, it's a club wanted me who had a great record and a great history behind itself. So, you know, it was never a worry from my point of view for moving down south.
Sure. So how did Cats sell the club to you?
Well, you know what, Cats like it. If he can sell rock, he can sell anything. he was great. I mean, I have to say, you know, there's lots of opinions, you know, about Cats. But I found him very, very, how can I say, influential in lots of things that I did. He was very animated in lots of areas. He was so enthusiastic in what he did. And that enthusiasm, it really pushed itself onto me, in fairness, because I felt if he's going to be like he is, you know, there's going to be some great success in the future at the football club. You know, if you've got that type of person that's running or managing you, you know, on a daily basis, you know, it's going to rub off on you a bit.
So when he did join, what did he initially ask of you? What did he feel that your role should be?
Well, I mean, he just wanted me to do what I was doing before, really. I think, as I mentioned before, I've got a little bit of everything, I thought, in my game. You know, I think more than anything, I had an aggressive streak for a little fella. I don't know, you know, whether that was right or wrong, but I did, and I like to win games. And going into the team that I did, I think it added not just a little bit more of physicality into the midfield, but also I had the option to go forward, and he gave me the freedom to go and score. You know, sure. It was absolutely brilliant, and I think that in that respect, that gave me a little bit more freedom than I had before. You know, and belief that people believed in me that helped me to do that.
So, talk us around your first dressing room, your first match you remember. Talk us around the dressing room that you recall from. I mean, we are talking now. Carry the one 38 years ago.
Yeah, exactly.
Sorry. tell us about, I mean, you said it was a family-oriented club, but tell us about, you know, the attitude in the changing room.
Well, the one thing that always I always say about Brighton as well, you know, it was such a close group. In the dressing room, you could have a great big, a lot of fun. You could have a bit of laughing before the kickoff. As soon as that whistle went, wow, you were in that mode straight away of winning games. You know, you didn't always win games. We know that. We know that's not, you know, prerequisite. But I think from that point of view, we were determined to try and do what we thought we could do every week was win every game. And I think that mentality, and if you didn't work as hard as you possibly could, if you didn't do the things, the basic things that you're expected to do, like running hard and working hard for your teammates, then the lads themselves would come down on top of you like a drop of cement on you. They wouldn't hang about. They didn't hold their views back. You know, you knew what your job was and your role in the team. And if you didn't do it, you'd be held to account. And that wasn't just by the manager. That was by the lads themselves. And I really appreciated that. I like that. You know, I like being dug out by my peers because it meant so much to each and every one of us.
I mean, there were still a lot of big characters in that dressing room. I mean, like I said, there was a lot of the cup final team was still there. Tony Grealish was still there. Steve Gatting was still there. Jimmy Case was still there as well, I think.
Still there. So, I mean,
it's a great side there.
Well, you've mentioned just a few of them there. So, you know, you didn't cross swords with them, boys. They've been there. You know, and I was bearing in mind I was still quite a young player. I was still a bit of a novice, you know, in that respect. And you know, so you know, learning my trade through the likes of those players you've mentioned, you know, that was brilliant from my point of view.
Yeah, and as a Liverpool fan, it must have been a thrill playing alongside Jimmy Case.
Well, I couldn't believe it. I mean, I'm sat next to Jimmy in the dressing room and I'm looking, you know, I think he had to shut my mouth about five times. He's handed the machine to put my mouth together. But Jimmy was fantastic. He was a man of few words, as you, I'm sure you know. But you knew when he did say something, it was very poignant. And I think with Jim, he just got on with things very quietly. Very, very efficiently, very effectively. And I like that word. Jim was, we used to call him the quiet assassin, you know, and he was certainly like that. You know, he's
certainly an assassin.
You've seen Graham Sooner top a few times. You couldn't have had a better debut, really, could you?
Go on, tell me, remind me.
Well, win 3-1 at home to Cardiff.
Cardiff, yes, it was Cardiff.
You score twice. Yes, and you forgot.
Well, it's not forgetting. It's just you get to my age now. You have memory blanks. it was. I wouldn't show it was a Cardiff or not. You endorse a Cardiff game. Yes, it was. Yeah. I mean, what more could you want?
Talk us through the goals, then, mate.
I can't. Show me a few clips, and maybe I'll tell you.
I mean, to be fair, there's a good chance I would have been there. So if we're talking. Since December 83, we're talking here. I'd have been 14. I'd have probably been allowed to, because in those days, I used to walk from where we lived near Preston Circus all the way out to the Golson Ground. It was about a 40-minute walk.
Right.
And every day it was either brilliant sunshine or chucking down with rain, because in those days, when we started, we didn't have a roof on the North Stand. And there was always, and this is probably the heart of the horrible part of football that we don't really want to talk about, but there was always seemed to be, certainly in the mid-80s, a scrap of some sort in Hove Park afterwards. I mean,
right.
It's just kind of my memories of 80s football. It's I have better memories of on-pitch stuff than off-pitch stuff. It's different these days, and we'll come to that later. But certainly back in those days, you know, it's a different thing. But it's just, I guess, probably, you know, when we are talking about, like, say, 37, 38 years ago, I guess after so many games, they just blur into each other, don't they?
Yeah.
Well, to a certain degree, they do. I think that, I mean, if it was solely as playing that I'm recalling, and I hadn't been in the manager's side of the game, it might be a lot easier to remember, you know. But, you know, when you go into the managerial side of it, I'm sure you'll want to call out later, but it's very difficult. You really focus and you zone in onto certain games, and then you forget about them, and you've got the next game straight away, and you try and blank everything that's connected with the last game, unless they're good things, obviously. But even then, you're preparing for a different type of game in the next one.
Sure.
So when you got that many games, I mean, nearly 2,000 games now, I think, fair enough, between managing and playing, it's a lot to remember. so I do apologise if I can't remember many of the games.
No, that's all right. But I mean, for me personally, I mean, and Al's just alluded to that as well. But for me personally, I mean, it was my favourite time ever of watching the Albion. That team that Chris Catlin put together,
it was a very good side on a shoestring,
and
wasn't it?
Yeah, and you know, we very nearly got out of that division at the right end as well. If the playoffs were in operation then, we would definitely have got out of that division, I think. But I mean, there was a lot of players that that Cat brought in, the likes of Steve Penny. We're going to talk about Fred.
I thought you might mention him, you know. Danny, I've got to say this. AD will tell, he's now too shy because he's mentioned it so many times. Steve Penny, with all due respect to your good self, is his all-time favourite Albion player. So could you actually just put AD at his rest and tell him, from your point of view, what you thought Steve Penny was like as a player and as a fella?
Steve was fantastic. I'll go as a person first. Stephen was an absolute diamond of a kid. Really, really nice boy. Typical Northern Ireland young lad, you know. He's a little bit chirpy, a little bit merry at times, but what a wonderful, wonderful personality. And as a player, I mean, he surprised so many people when he got on that pitch in the opposition teams. You know, they didn't expect what he was capable of. They didn't know what he was capable of, but he had great pace, great feet. You know, he a little bit erratic at times, but he was only a young boy, you know. But
yeah.
But he was brilliant in the team because we could give him the ball and he just set off with the ball and give us all the rest. You know, he was tremendous. And fit boy, very, very athletic, box to box quite easily. You know, training was just a doggle for him. He was a great, great boy. And, yeah. And I bumped into him about 2 years ago, actually, over in Ireland playing golf. And he's not changed one
bit. That sounds about right. Well, he does look a lot like Michael Portillo now. Including the red trousers.
I was about to say, it's a pink shirt and green jacket, isn't it?
And but well, he runs a Specsavers franchise now, but he spends all his time playing golf. But you must have played with him for Northern Ireland as well.
Yes, I did. Yeah, I did. Not many times, but I did. Yes, yeah. It's obviously he'd been a little bit younger than me, you know. Then obviously he had a little bit more time after I left as well. But Stephen was in the squad. You know, on a lot of occasions.
Yeah. But that team that we had there, what I was going to allude to, there's one or two players that actually got away as well, which one of which, like Catlin, is still devastated about, which was the fact that he could have had a strike partnership of Dean Saunders and Ian Wright.
Yeah, I believe that's all, yeah. By the way, that wouldn't have been bad, would it? You know, if Dean Saunders...
You've got a few more win bonuses.
Yeah, I think it would have been an absolute dream, wouldn't it?
Absolutely.
Never materialised, unfortunately, but it was very, very appetising.
Now, moving forward, I think pretty much to the end of that first season, and, you know, with 1984, that first season back down, you know, it was kind of finished ninth, you know, a little bit adrift, didn't probably go as well as one would have hoped. But I think it was at the end of that season, and again, it's one of those things that Chris Catlin gets the blame for, but Steve Foster was effectively, they gave him a missive. We've got to offload the wages a wee bit. And Steve Foster had to go. And I can't remember if it was during the close season or certainly, you know, into the following season. But, you know, you alluded earlier in the show about how much he helped you settled in. I mean, how much of a hole did he leave when he left?
Well, somebody, not just as a player, like Fozzie was, but his character-wise as well. He left a massive hole in the dressing room. You can ask any of the boys, I'm sure that you have, and I hope that I've got on the right track at this. He was a fantastic, fantastic person to have in your dressing room.
Yeah.
He could bring everybody together, brought the wives and that together on match days, families and what have you. You know, if it was a social thing, we all went out together. Fozzie was the main instigator of all of that type of thing. But when he got on the pitch, he was a leader. He could pull and push people around. He had that type of authority in his stature and in the way he played. And you wanted to do it for him. That was a good thing about it. You didn't ask or argue any question. You just believed what he was saying was right, and you did what he asked you to do. And obviously, those characters, I mean, they're crying out for them nowadays. If you listen to any modern-day manager now, they're crying out for characters like Steve. You know, and they're just not about anymore. A lot of people, they just follow like sheep on other people. Fozzie was a colossus in what he did and how he was dominant on the pitch and against the opposition as well. He could talk opposition out of the game quite easily. Like, you know,
yeah,
as well. You know, it wasn't just for us. He could sort one or two centre forwards out and, you know, another player as well. So all round contribution to the team and to the club was fantastic with Fozzie. And he did leave a massive, massive gap.
But his exit meant an elevation for you. I mean, correct me if I'm wrong, but wasn't it the case that then Cat made you captain?
He did, yeah. Yes, he did, yeah.
And like you say, this is only, 8 months after having joined the club. You said you were 21. I think I've looked at you, you were 23, but you're 24. Captain of the Albion, following in these sort of, as you've just put it, huge shoes. I mean, how did you feel when he turned around to you and said, right, Danny, you're skipper?
How did I feel? I felt 10 foot tall. That's how I felt. I mean, what a privilege to be asked by any football club, but certainly one, you know, as big as Brighton. You know, it was a massive, massive shot in the arm for me, confidence-wise. You know, and from that point of view, you know, it did help me a great deal. But Fozzie had helped me a great deal before in, you know, how he approached being captain. It's not just a name. You know, there's far, far more to to the armband, you know, than just wearing it. Because, you know, the things that happen within the club and people are, you know, looking up to you and looking at you as an example more than anything. Mm. And so I'd learned a lot from that off Steve. And so I think it was a big help play with him. To take over the captaincy as I did, it wasn't a burden whatsoever. Some people can, you know, enjoy the responsibility, so other people might shrink under it. But I certainly enjoyed it. But I think it's because I'd learned a lot from Steve at the time I was there.
I mean, we hear an awful lot of stories about the Fozzies. How can I put this? The team bonding days. We've done a few of our theatre shows from Fozzie's nightclub, actually, which is now called a theatre called the Rialto here. But I mean, tell us about your time off the pitch in Brighton.
Well, crikey, brilliant. I mean, listen, we were never in. I mean, apart from the days that we had to be in, when we weren't allowed to go out and socialise and drink, you know, so like, you know, Mondays, Tuesdays, Wednesdays, it was mostly out. You know, then Thursday, Friday, you were preparing for the game. And but it never changed. You know, we could perch as well as we played. You know, we had great nights. We had great nights with the families. We had great nights just with the lads. It was all part and parcel of that family that I spoke about before. And Brighton, you know, Brighton's is what it is. Brighton's it's a holiday resort, you know. And sometimes we treat it as a holiday. Sometimes
that's a lovely way. Whereabouts were you living when you were down here?
I was living in Hove.
Got you.
Yeah, I was in Hove. Yeah.
So not too far from the action then.
No. Well, no, not really. No, not far at all. Really, no. It's bearing in mind both my children were born in Brighton as well.
Oh right,
yeah. So it was a really busy time for me down there. Not just with the football, but obviously my wife and having the children, which was absolutely fantastic. So coming back up to North as we have, you know, we've got a son and a daughter who people still say they've got a bit of a twang of Brighton. Yeah. I don't think.
I mean, let's face it. How lucky are they to have Brighton on their birth certificate? I mean, you know. I mean, that's akin to royalty these days.
But,
we were talking about nights out in Brighton, which leads us nicely on to another player that you've probably got fond memories of playing with. And he was one hell of a player. And we've sadly lost him this week. And that was, of course, Frank Worthington.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I mean, you know, people ask me many, many times, you know, when, you know, who's your favourite player? Who's the best player you've played with? And people be thinking, you know, because it was Sheffield Wednesday and we had a great team of Chrissy Waddle and people like that, and then Nottingham Forest and, you know, and Viv Anderson, all right. But, you know, a lot of people do forget about Frank. Frank was an absolute genius on the pitch. The one thing that stood out more than anything for me, apart from his ability, which was obviously everybody knew, it was how tough he was. He was as hard as nails. Nobody thought, you know, a striker with that ability could take this stick that he took and dish it out as well. Frank was a big, strong fellow, like, you know, and that really opened my eyes, really, of somebody who, you know, who was wantonly kicked from pillar to post by defenders when they got the chance to catch him, and he would give just as much back again. And I thought he was brilliant. But yeah, on the ball, obviously, you know, you'll have seen lots of clips now at the moment in time of his ability. It was great to play with. Once you stuck that ball up to him, you know he's going to stick for you. Now, whether he did a trick or not before you got it back again was another story. You could make about 10 runs for him, he wouldn't give you the ball, he'd still be juggling it. But that was just because he had that great belief in himself and a great ability to do what he did.
Well, I think a lot of people got to the Goldstone ground early just to watch him warm up. Yeah. You know, he would do those circus tricks. He'd do those, you know, the juggles and the keepy uppies and the sort of stuff that, frankly, you don't normally see players doing. I mean, if they're mucking about now, they do that. But when it was Frank Worthington, you know, he also did it with sort of grace and flair. There was this kind of fluid movement. I mean, I always think of him. I mean, you're going to tell me it's not the case, but it's just for me, as someone who sat in the centre circle, spraying passes around, getting everyone else to do the work. And that's probably a little bit unfair because, you know, when you're 36 and still playing second division football, yeah, it must mean something about your constitution that, you know, you're still playing that hard and that well, Danny.
Well, and by the way, you do remember as well, in those days, the defenders had carte blanche and license to kick whoever they wanted and get away with it.
Yeah.
And so not like nowadays, but and you had to take it, which was what Frank did.
And he always wore his socks around his ankles without the shin pads as well, like a lunatic.
Yeah. He did, yeah. He did. I mean, he was a tough old character. Yeah. And he was 36. And yes, his legs may have gone a little bit. And yes, he would expect the ball to his feet. He would, because he would expect what he's playing with. I've got quality around me. Why can't I get the ball to my feet? Yeah. And so that was our goal. That, you know, we had something that we had to work on. We couldn't be sticking balls willy-nilly over the top of defenders and expecting to run at it. So yeah. It gave us a focus as well. You know, we had to work on our game and we had to find the way to get to play to his strengths. And yeah. And so in that respect, that was difficult as well. You know, we had to work even harder to change our game, you know, to what we were playing with and what was in the team and how we're getting the best out of them. And the best to get to Frank was particularly around the edge of the box, sticking it to his feet and just see what happened. You know, we didn't know what was going to happen. You know, he could slide one down the outside. He could you know, he could flip one around the corner. He could swivel and hit one himself. We didn't know. But we had to give him the support that just in case he had it.
Yeah, I mean, it is truly criminal how overlooked these true football artists have been by England over the years. I mean, Frank only got 8 England caps. Letitiae, Hoddle. Yeah, I mean, these players who just were absolute proper artists on the football pitch. They just never got the opportunity at international level. It's such a shame.
Well, it isn't. You know what? I think we were talking. I mean, it's quite topical because of last night and the game against San Marino. And the result that England had and the young players that were in there and the quality of the player that was played in an international. And you've got to look at the revolution that Gareth Ainsworth has brought around with the national team.
He's done Gareth Ainsworth? Grimey, Wickham are doing really well.
he was on television the next one thinking.
I thought he'd had a new haircut.
Gareth, he's a real revolution, what he did, because at the time, if you remember, the players that were available to him, the likes of Rooney's and this, and he left them out of the squad. You know, and it was a big decision to make to sort of go away from that type of player and bring in these players that we're seeing now on a regular basis. So I think in the years that Frank played it for England and what have you, and the Glenn Hoddle's, like you just mentioned, there was that thought, and the fans as well wanted that big tough man, and you know that hard ones, the ones who go through a brick wall for you. But perhaps he didn't win as many games as he could have done if they kept on with Glenn Hoddle type of player.
Right. Yeah,
you know, it's a debate that will never answer itself. Yeah. Therein lies the point. But, I mean, like, you know, your ideal midfield partnership was, as Cluffy put it when he signed Andy Rawlings, you want a violinist and a hod carrier. You know, so, you know, which one were you then, by the way?
Oh, I was always a hog carrier, don't worry about that.
I still think you're being harsh on yourself here. Let's go back to the Goldstone, Danny, and the 84-85 season, which is actually still on certain levels, it's still a record-breaking season for the Albion. And it was a case of so near yet so far in the end, wasn't it?
Well, yeah, it was. And I think that, I'm saying it from our point of view, I think the promises were, you know, were there. I'm very disappointed at the end of it. But going back again, you know, we had some fantastic results, some fantastic play. You know, obviously we didn't have that finishing edge that all teams need. We didn't manage to finish the job off, which was very unfortunate.
Sounds familiar, doesn't it? Plus ça change, plus c'est la même. Yeah, I'm just looking at the final table here. It was 31 home goals. And you think, well, bearing in mind that the team that finished top, Oxford, scored 62 at home.
Yeah.
You know, I think you probably sort of, as you've hit the nail on the head. I mean, I don't think it was a problem with defence. And this is where I'm saying it's record-breaking, is that we only conceded 34 goals all league season. And in a 42-match season, that's still a club record. So was it, do you feel that the Cat was too defensive or was there just not the quality? Where did it go wrong? Where did it not happen?
Well, I think, you know, I've managed teams, so I'm going to stick up for for Cat here. You know, I've managed teams that you play in a certain manner that the fans want you to do more. But if you don't have the players at your disposal, it's difficult to put a certain style of play on. And if you do that, then you're weakening the strengths that those players have. I think if Cat himself thought that, you know, if we opened ourselves up, we would be punished, and then we couldn't score enough goals that we needed to win a game. So he decided to keep it nice and tight. And, you know, and we've seen many, many teams win things being played like that. You can go back to Arsenal of the, you know, of their era when, you know, they're called 1-0. You know, whether that's right or wrong, you know, that's for argument, you know, in another day. But, you know, but the success that Arsenal had, the fans were more than happy with it. Now, look at them later on when you get Arsene Wenger and the style of play changes completely. You know, but do you win as much as George did, you know, with us? I don't know. So there's always an argument for and against it. From Brian's point of view, I think that I think Chris looked at what we had and we played in a certain way. And we possibly could have been more offensive. But if we had done that and conceded goals, we'd have been accused of not being able to defend. Yeah.
Obviously,
don't get me wrong. I don't recall, even say 36 years later, I don't recall it being boring. And I don't even recall it being sort of not entertaining. It was, and we could see the quality that was out there. I think sometimes we're happy with scraping a 1-0 win. I mean, one of my ongoing memories of the Goldstone was it was never a great pitch. I don't know if that's true or not, and I do bow to the ghost of Glenn Wilson if I've upset him there. But, you know, I don't recall the goals from never being a particularly great pitch to play on. Am I wrong?
It got very heavy.
Yeah.
It used to get very heavy. But, I mean, that wasn't just the goals. I think most pitches up and down the country were like that.
Probably, you know, yeah.
They didn't have the luxury of playing on the Premiership pitches like we have nowadays.
Sure.
Or Championship pitches. You know, it's what it was. And, you know, an investment on, and then, you know, the new types of grasses you could get later on were there to be seen. But, you know, it was just a normal pitch that cuts up when it rained, you know, and when you've got good players on there, they find it difficult. Frank Worthington found it difficult at times, you know. And so I think, you know, you do play in a certain way as well. If you're trying to get the ball on the ground and go through your way through opposition teams on a pitch that's a plowed field, you're going to find it more difficult than to go over the top of it.
Yeah. Did you notice the Goldstone pitch being particularly slopey?
Did I notice it was slopey?
Did you know? Cause, I mean, because when you're looking at it from slightly above, you can see the slope slightly down towards the south end. Did you feel it when you were playing on it?
Yeah, you didn't necessarily feel it, no. But you knew it was there. Yeah, definitely.
Okay. Yeah. Aidy?
Yeah, so I was just looking at the programmes from back then, actually. Just seeing who else.
Danny Wilson's haircut hasn't changed.
That hasn't changed.
It hasn't.
Mine definitely has.
It's a lockdown on this one at the moment.
the team did start to break apart a little bit, and there was obviously signs that off the pitch that things weren't going as well as they possibly could do. And we saw some of the crown jewels being sold off for next to nothing. I mean, Dean Saunders going to Oxford for 60 grand.
I've got to look at that one. Dean Saunders for 60 grand, just because it was the first bid that was accepting. Could you see anything going, you know, could you, as players, could you see, hang on, what the blazes is going on here?
That's a tough question, really, because we didn't used to think of the other side of the game as much as talked about now, you know. But we just accepted that, you know, players moved on. Another good player will hopefully come in and replace them. I don't think we had as much of an issue with the thought pattern you just spoke about there in those days that we have nowadays. It's not analysed like it is nowadays. From our perspective, we just got on with it. We let the people upstairs do what they did, and we did what we did. You know, the manager would tell you what he wanted you to hear, or what he wanted you to know.
Yeah.
And we accepted it. That was it. You know, end of story. There could have been anything going on, anything, you know, untoward going on, but we didn't know about it. Yeah. We weren't particularly bothered about it, if I'm honest.
Yeah. You must have been there when Alan Mullery came back. Were you there when Alan Mullery came back?
Yes, I was, yeah. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah. Because, yep. I mean, that definitely, that did not go well.
Well, he didn't, did he? It didn't go as well as we thought it was going to go. But I got on very well with Alan, I have to say. I liked him a lot. I mean, obviously, his history of being a fantastic player, you know, a midfield player, you know, it really inspired me a bit, if I'm quite honest. And I had a very good relationship with him. So to see it not go as well as it could have done for him was disappointing, to say the least.
Yeah, so I mean, obviously you went into management yourself, and you've worked with some really, really top managers, so like the likes of Brian Clough, Chris Catlin, David Plee, Alan Mullery. I mean, what did you take from that into your management career?
What did you take? You don't consciously take a lot of things in with you, if I'm honest. I think what you're trying to do, you look at certain experiences that you've seen or you've had to you and how it was dealt with by the management. I think they're the ones more than anything. You know, every manager that I've had, every coach I've had, have always been very positive in what they wanted to put on the pitch, which meant an attractive team and go and enjoy yourself, warm yourself up, don't leave anything on the pitch. You know what your responsibilities are off, away from possession or out of possession. But in possession, you've got to go on and show, you know, what a good player you are. And more than anything, if you sat in I remember Ron Atkinson saying to us once, you know, when he sat in the stand watching a game, he wants to be on the end of his seat. He didn't want to be reading his programme, you know. And I think that's about right. You know, I think that's every manager that I've had, I've had that type of outlook and that type of approach to the game. So that's more than anything I've taken on board. As it goes, how your management style goes, I think you're just true to yourself. You just got to be what you are yourself. You can't be trying to be somebody else, you know, and try and manage like somebody else did. If anybody tried to manage like Brian Clough did, he'd fall every week, you know, it's because he was unique. You know, Ron Atkinson was unique. Cat himself was unique. You know, they've all got their own ways. And I think, you know, all you can ask for them is to be true to yourself, to be true to the player, but be true to yourself. And I think if you do that, you've got a chance of lasting.
Now, the main talking point of probably the 85-86 season, again, a sort of kind of a mid-table league campaign, but it was the FA Cup. We got to the FA Cup quarter-final. Yeah. And just before we started recording this, I showed you basically something you had once upon a time, which was a shirt you wore in a match against Peterborough. That was a ridiculous game to play in, wasn't it, on the snow?
Yes, it was. I remember we didn't get called off in those days, did we?
Yeah.
Well, let's be right. We could play ice rinks. It was all right. You know, there was very, very few that were called off. They had to be really atrocious conditions and really, really, you know, dangerous for players not to go ahead, for referees not to go ahead with the games. And again, you know, there's a thing of costing and, you know, games getting called off and costs. You know, that clubs couldn't afford to do. They wanted a replay. They didn't want a game postponed and be already in the vicinity of the venue and then come back again 3 or 4 days later. So there were very few games were called off unless they needed to score. And the Peterborough game was a perfect example of that.
Absolutely. I mean, one of the things, there's certain things you remember about that. One is obviously the red shirt, and they're all short sleeve shirts, which is, you know, kind of mad in the first instance. I think Peterborough got their equaliser by the ball hitting a mound of snow and bouncing over Perry Digley, which itself was funny. But actually, something you may not have realised, and I don't know if you realised it at the time, was actually it was the fans. And in those days, they had the terrace. And I think the terrace has only just been rebuilt into seats behind the goal. It's just how crowded it was. And this was Hillsborough tragedy. I think it was a terrace that held about 3,500, and there must have been 5,000. It's one of those games where you're absolutely terrified because you're so squashed. If your arms go up, they're staying up. If they're down, they're staying down. And it was just sort of, you know, actually a very unpleasant experience for us. We wanted to enjoy the game as much as you could, you know, when you see these 22 Bambis on ice trying to dance around the snow. And thankfully, like I said, we got our draw, but It is one of those sort of those who were there will witness the just how surreal that game was.
Well, like you said before, I mean, thankfully there was no there's no danger to the fans in that particular game, but we've seen, you know, that that doesn't work anymore. Wow. You know, so thankfully, you know, we got a hell of a lot more safety aspects of stadiums nowadays, which is great. But going back, I mean, it's going back to the Peterborough game, if you like.
Yeah.
I mean, because you said there was that many people, our supporters, sorry, at the game, and so jam packed in it. That atmosphere as well that it generates, it was, you can't really put it into words, really. You have to experience it when the amount of people like that are behind you. And I don't mean behind the goals, I mean behind your team.
Sure.
It means so much to them, and you go the extra yard for them, I promise you do. You know, and I think that when you turn up in conditions like they do turn up, and watching maybe first of all football sometimes in those conditions, you wonder, you know, why the hell they carry on with it. But that's why their heart and soul is with the football club.
Yeah. I mean, just to fast forward to now briefly, I mean, obviously with everyone playing in empty stadiums at the moment, I mean, it must be terrible for the players playing like that.
Well, I've seen a couple of games in the empty stadiums, you know, and it's really eerie. It is, and I think the football actually has got better, you know, over the last 4 or 5 months in terms of the competitiveness on the pitch. Where I thought a little bit at first, when they first started, the running wasn't quite as energetic, you know, the tackles weren't maybe as fierce, you know, it was a very, very strange and eerie atmosphere for the players. I think they're sorting out a bit now, but there's still a massive gap. There's still, you know, you cannot have football without fans.
Yeah, I mean, we were talking on the show a week or so ago about the way that players react to playing in the empty stadiums, and that certain players are probably what we would call a stadium player. They riff off the people being there, off people giving them stick and the banter and stuff, and not having that, their game suffers.
Well, yeah, and I think, you know, the success and the lack of success for certain clubs at this stage as well is very apparent. You know, I think, you know, the teams that really rely on the fans, and I'll go to Brighton to a certain degree, I'll go to Sheffield United, you know, whereas last season they were fantastic. The fans got behind them, particularly at home, you know, away from home, they take 5,000 with them, you know, and really they were so passionate. And they got results for them, you know. There's no doubt about it. It wasn't just the players; the fans got that result for them. And I think that's where they're missing them. You know, the big clubs have the bigger players, the better players. We know that. But the inspiration that the fans can give the lesser player playing against that particular talented player, it levels it up a great deal. You know, and I think this is that one of the seasons this year where it's been very, very, very apparent that fans do help, you know, the lesser clubs, if you understand what I mean. Not,
yeah, 12th man. The 12th man. Give you that little extra push over the cliff when you need it.
Yeah, certainly, yeah.
Over the cliff, mate. Believe me, not over the cliff. No. Okay, let's go back to your final season at the Goldstone. It kind of ended in a little bit of a damp squib. I mean, there seemed to be politics at the top of the club going on. Catlin was a victim to it. We've spoken to Chris about you know, what happened, and to this day he's still absolutely baffled. Like I say, Mullery came in, and then Barry Lloyd came in, and it was all over the place. I mean, how were you about this? I mean, obviously you went on to Luton and you had some silverware success with them, but you know, could you see the writing on the wall at the club?
I'm not sure you can see the writing on the wall of the club. I think when you get transferred in those days, maybe it's different now. In those days, you didn't really, really want to leave a football club unless somebody came in for you. You weren't one of these, you know. The agents weren't dominant, you know. That sort of turn heads from the clients to other football clubs or money or whatever it may be. In our day, there was nothing like that. You generally only left the club if somebody came in for you and the club had accepted a fee for you.
Yeah.
And that was all it was at Brighton from my point of view. You know, I've never asked to go. I'd never had any disagreement with anybody. I wasn't unhappy at all. You know, like I said before, my family were very settled in Brighton. It was our second home down there. It was fantastic. So for somebody to come in again of the calibre of Luton and the players that Luton had at that time, you know, you think, you know, well, and you look at the teams here, and if Brighton need the money, maybe I'm doing them a favour, you know, by agreeing to go, you know. And if I'd have said no, you know, would they have had the money to survive in different areas? I don't know. But I said yes simply because, you know, if a club have agreed a fee with another club, then it's virtually done deal, and it's just up to you to sort yourself out there. But then being Luton, don't forget, it was Fozzy again, going in to see Fozzy at Luton again, and the players that they had there as well, you know, the Ricky Hills international, the Steens, etc.
Yeah.
They had a very good side, and that was what was a big problem as well.
Mick Harford was there as well, wasn't he? Les Seeley?
Yeah. They had a very, very good side.
Yeah. It's still Luton though, isn't it?
So in that case, I mean, you know, it's tell us about, because I remember watching it, and there was an element of David and Goliath about it, but tell us about that League Cup final.
Well, it was. I mean, I think everybody wanted that Luton to win that day, didn't they, apart from the Arsenal fans? It was one of those days where we possibly couldn't have played as well as we did. Arsenal had made a few mistakes and we punished them for them. And then, you know, when we got back to 2-2, but you know, we were in the ascendancy. Anything could happen. You know, we were expecting to go into extra time. I think that Arsenal were expecting the game to go to extra time, and then they just see us off, you know, with a few goals in extra time. And we pounced in the last minute, you know, with Ashley Grimes put a great ball over, and Brian Steen gets the winning with virtually minutes to go, less than minutes to go. So it was a real fantastic moment in my career, because underdogs don't always get what you want them to get, do you? But
no,
we've done that a few times. It's not the first time that's happened to us. So I'm quite thrilled that I've been part of three or four times that it's happened. So maybe I'm a bit of a jinx on some of the big clubs.
And as a player, of course, you want to win things. So, you know, and not many players do actually get to win things.
You look at Luton's team, they were full of internationals, you know. But they didn't get the credit they were. I mean, you've got your Harford, and you've got Fozzie of England, Mal Donaghy from Ireland, you've got Ashley Grimes from Republic of Ireland, Ricky Hill, England. You know, so you can go through lots of them at the club. So it wasn't, they weren't, although they were a small club, they were no mugs. Ray Harford had put a very, very good team together there. And I think we surprised one or two people on the day, but it didn't surprise us because we knew we had quality in the side. And I felt just the same way the first time I went down to Brighton, like I said, and you know, the quality was there, but we didn't actually win anything like we did at Luton.
Now, obviously, we've got to fast forward a little bit. Now, you did end up in the dugout, and you've gone on to have a decent managerial career. At one point, I think they even said that you got Barnsley playing like Brazil, which is a bit mad, really. But I mean, Barnsley and Brazil in the same sentence—that's not something you hear very often. But it's.
Aidy, you're being a real cultural snob this hour, aren't you?
I really am.
Someone from Burgess Hill, that's saying something.
True. This is very true. Still, but Burgess Hill's still nicer than Luton.
A few Luton people might argue with that.
Well, there is that. In your managerial career, I mean, you've had some great success. You probably had sort of other days where you think, what's the point in... You know, you want to throw the keys in back through the door. And what is it about a manager when it's not going right? I mean, when it's going right, we can all say that. But the loneliness of the first team manager, where does the will come from to go on when it's not going right? Where is the will that says hold on?
The will is instilled in you. I think it's what you've had as part of your character. I think that. If you're one of those that give up very easily, you would never. And once you've been made, a couple of games in professional football in the first place, so you have a determination. The older you get, and particularly the more longevity you have in the managerial seat, the tougher that rhino skin becomes, and you have to have it. There's a million and one opinions every game that you play, you know. So you've got to listen to it to a certain degree. You know, you've got to accept there's going to be criticism. You've got to accept there's going to be praise, but you've got to try and keep that equilibrium about it. You've got to keep your feet on the ground. You've got to believe in what you're doing. You've got to get the players more than anything to take on board and believe what you want to do. And if you can do that, then you're doing your job. And I think, you know, that's the thing that, from my point of view, that I've enjoyed for most of my career in the managerial side of it, is that, you know, we've achieved things, you know, that won't be success, that won't be winning things, that won't be doing lots of things. But I think we've assessed situations where we've avoided relegation, which is success. We've stayed afloat, which is success. And but people don't see that sometimes. But no, I just think it's all the way through. It's a mental thing.
So with all that in mind, how much did the 2004 playoff final piss you off?
No, not to, listen. He said, "Look at that. I've got a tough skin." I told you. I think there's lots of things that you can. I mean, I've had three playoff disappointments, you know, and all for different reasons, you know. And so I think in that respect, you know, you look at little certain defining moments within that in the games that's not fell your way. Mm-hmm. I mean, Sheffield United. We go to Sheffield. We have Sheffield United, and we have the final against Huddersfield. It goes to penalties. You know, and it goes, and it's and Huddersfield win 11-10, and our goalkeeper takes a penalty and blasts it over the bar. Now, why goalkeepers are allowed to take penalties or have to take penalties, in my opinion, is ridiculous. They never take penalties ever. You know, it should be 1-10 and 1-10.
Oh, I don't know, Kevin Pressman.
Oh, Kevin Pressman's a one-off. You know, he's a one-off. But I think in general, why would an outfield? Why would you put a goalkeeper in an outfield player's position?
And there's was a Chilavert as well.
Well, you got David Harvey, I think, set the scene.
Yeah. Well, I think overall, you know, it's an argument that we can all have and have agreements or not. But what I'm saying, the defining moments in games, so they're very, very fine, these areas. And it's difficult to get over them at a time. The disappointment is massive, and particularly for the fans, if not for the players, you know, it's very similar. But you've got to get over it. As a manager, you've got to try and get through those moments and get positive again as quick as you possibly can. And,
absolutely.
And that's all you can do. You know, if you mourn about it and you bemoan about it, you'll never be able to concentrate on your next job.
Okay. Well, let's fast forward to now, Danny. Your old clubs had a four seasons in the Premier League, hoping to make that a record fifth season. What have you made of them?
At this moment in time, I think they're very unfortunate to be in the position that, yeah, that they're fighting, you know, a relegation battle. And they are. There's no getting away from it. Although, you know, that result that they had the weekend against
Newcastle
was massive, you know, and those 3 points could be very much definitive. But I think the other side of it, I don't think they should be there anyway. I think they've been, of all the teams that struggled this year and all the teams I've seen, only on TV is as you know, they seem like they're the best of the bunch that's down there, without a doubt. They look confident. I love the way that Graham goes around his business. I think he doesn't flap, he doesn't panic. He's a very, very, you know, across the line. He keeps his level of his enthusiasm is never up and down. He's just boom. And I think the players feed off that. If the players were getting excitable or is getting too down and too animated, I think you see erratic performances. And I don't think you get that. I think you've had more consistency in your performances than the teams that's all around you there this season.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, you mentioned the Newcastle game last Saturday there. Now, with your managerial head on, now, this was a massive game for both sides and only one team bothered its arse to show up. It was... from a Newcastle point of view, I mean, would you be able to justify that performance?
Well, as a manager, you have to. But as a manager, you find that sometimes difficult to explain to anybody how your team can play like that in the circumstances and the surroundings that you're in that game and what it means to the club. You know, the manager will always take the brunt of the criticism when Stevie Bruce is taking that now. You know, in abundance, he's coming from all angles. People don't actually dig the players out at times. You know, there's players in that football side there that I would get in the dressing room after the game and personally give a wallop myself, even though they're only 6'10". I don't know. But because they don't go out there, they don't look like that everything means, it doesn't mean enough to them like it would the fans. They're going to get that criticism, but they can dodge it. The players can dodge it quite easily, and then it all falls back on the management. The management has a responsibility. We get that. You know, we don't hide from that fact. And Steve's never hidden once, which I like as well. He's come out in front of the cameras all the time. Every defeat, he's had to come out and he's had to explain somebody's mistake or somebody's lack of doing something. You know, and I feel at the moment in time now, Newcastle as a group, they're feeling sorry for themselves, and I can only see the worst happening. I think they have to be very careful. Fulham have had a very good run. Can they see another three or four wins? You can see that. Can you see Newcastle? Not unless they get the likes of Wilson back and people like that, the big players that they've got at the club, get them back on the pitch, and they might see a little bit of light at the end of the tunnel. But after that result and the performance against Brighton,
I think they've got to have a complete change of attitude, haven't they? I mean, like I say, yeah, certainly feeling sorry for themselves, but it's a complete change of attitude, which, you know, it's kind of interesting that, you know, we're not in a position to argue with you as a professional, but as a fan, you say, but we also know that surely the players have a responsibility to be, you know, both small and large P professional. In other words, you know, the will to carry on, the will to do their job should come from within and shouldn't have to require a manager. That you know, all players should surely be low maintenance enough. But yeah, the manager gets a certain amount of flack for it for being, you know, the puppet master, the string puller. But surely those players are letting Stevie Bruce down.
Well, you know, I could understand if it was a young team. I could understand if it was young lads who'd never been in that environment before, you know, never really had that sort of pressure. You can understand that to a certain degree, but not with the team they've got. He's got a very experienced team there. He's got players in there who know exactly what it takes to win games in the Premiership, in any division, but particularly the Premiership. You have to have a work ethic that is second to none. That's the first prerequisite you have before you go on the pitch. You know that whoever you're playing against is not going to work any harder than you. Now, if you've got the ability as well as that, and the ability and that mental strength to go beyond that, then great. But you cannot come off that football pitch knowing that the team's worked harder than you. And if you are coming off the pitch and you think in your own mind that you possibly could have done a bit better, then you don't start pointing the finger at somebody else. You just look at yourself in the mirror. I don't think enough people look at themselves in the mirror before they start pointing the finger. And I think that's maybe a problem. Maybe there's little bits of stuff that's going on within the dressing room. I don't know.
Yeah.
Okay, Danny, just before we wrap it up then, so you've got no plans of going back to the dugout?
Are you fucking sure?
Luckily, that's only going on the podcast, AD. That's not going on the radio.
No, I'm not. I think I've had a good time. I've had 40-odd years in football, you know, at the cutting edge show. And I think when you get to management as well, you neglect so much in your personal life. Because you're completely enthralled in your football. It's 24/7. You know, your family misses out on things. And I decided a couple of years ago that, you know, I've had a good innings of it. Like I say, over, you know, nearly 1,200 games as manager and nearly 700 games as a player. And I thought that my wife deserved a little bit of attention at times, you know, to take a break now and again, go on a holiday. The kids are growing up.
So when's she sending you back to work then?
Next Thursday. we didn't count on the flipping lockdown though, did we? so I think I'll leave it to the young lads on the touchline. They're more equipped for you.
One last question then, Danny. Now, as AD said at the top of the show, you're a lad from Wigan. Did you ever go to the Wigan Casino?
Yes. And believe this or not, my first time I went there, I was 14. I shouldn't have been in there.
Yeah. And what do you remember dancing to? Any particular favourite tracks?
Any particular ones? There was a few that, a friend of mine, well, one of my best friends and his brothers, three brothers of Blads, used to go to the casino, older than me. Quick story. And he used to import and export singles from America, which were obviously the soul music, you know, the all-nighters music and what have you. And so he used to take them down to the actual DJ at Wigan Casino, and he used to borrow them for the night. But that boy who get borrow him the records, he used to be the first one to get up and, before anybody got up to start a dance, he would set all the dancing off. And he would do all the other, it's like skiing in the snow and all things like that. Records. And he was the first one to get everybody going. And he invited me down, I was 14, and I wanted to go in and not drink, obviously.
Of course.
And obviously all nights as well. But I think
you popped the pills instead, didn't you? You popped the pills instead.
Yeah, they were flipping short pills, yeah.
So, go on, if you can, what's your top three all-time Northern Soul favourites?
Oh, crikey. I just can't remember them all now. You know, Skiing in the Snow and Brigands of Ayrshire, that was a big one that everybody used to start off with, that one. There was one called, I think it was The Snake.
Al Wilson, yeah.
Al Wilson, yeah, that's the one. I'm trying to think of the others. I just can't remember the other ones.
Do you remember things like Ghost in My House?
Yeah, Ghost in My House, yeah, that was a good one.
That was a good one, yeah. I'm going to run away from you.
As
AD will point out, quite boringly, I'm a soul aficionado here. He's more into his heavy rock. I mean, I know we have other things there, but yeah, it is a case of talking to those who are from Wigan, you know, those who were there. I just love hearing those stories.
Yeah, I mean, I wasn't quite old enough. I shouldn't have gone, but I went on two occasions, I think I did. 14 being the one, about 15 was the next one, but never stayed overnight, if you know what I mean.
Yeah.
You know, when I was 16, I was then travelling to Bury on the train on the Monday morning. They'd still be sleeping on the platforms, you know, from coming back from the all-nighter weekend, you know, when they was going back over there. So I don't know if it was good or that I missed it or not, I don't know, but a lot of people are in the right state on the Sunday and Monday mornings, I know that.
Fantastic. So what do you want, the big Oxford bags, the, you know, the Pippity vests and...
Yeah, exactly, yeah.
And that's all we've got time for. So thank you to the brilliant Danny Wilson. Thank you to Alan Wares. I've been A.D. Packham, and this has been the Albion Roar in association with oldfootballshirts.com. We'll see you again next week.